Well, folks, here we are for this week's culture segment, and I have the privilege of introducing you to John Weiss. He is an author as well as a pastor. He is pastor of Southland Christian Church in Lexington. And the book that we're going to actually talk about today is Me Too, Experience the God Who Understands. He also has a book out called Jesus Prom, which we're going to talk about a little bit later, just briefly, because, you know, what in the world is that about? But John, welcome to the Boundless Show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lisa. I appreciate it.
Well, this is a cool opportunity for us. And of course, the topic, because young adults are no strangers to frustration about life and certainly brokenness. We talk here a lot about the generational stuff that our folks have inherited from the boomer parents that they have, and kind of the brokenness even in their own homes, and then translated into their own stories. And certainly we've accumulated kind of our own stuff as a result of sin and just the burdens of life and stuff. And I'm sure you're no stranger to that either.
Not at all.
So one thing that's kind of nutty in your story, I mean, you've just been kind of all over. I mean, I want to kind of start out by talking about you spending 4 years in Haiti, which is actually where you met your wife, right?
Yes. My okay. wife and I were school teachers there.
Okay. So did you go to Haiti? I mean, how did that process come about? And I'm assuming you didn't go to Haiti and say, oh, yeah, this is where I'm going to meet my wife.
But no. Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't through a dating website.
No.
We didn't have our first date there.
HaitiDate.com?
That's right.
No.
That's
okay.
Right.
Yeah. Tell us what happened. How did the ministry transpire there, and how did you two meet?
Sure. We both of us grew up here in the States, obviously. My parents had this huge heart for people in need, and so when I was a little boy, they opened up our home to refugees during the Vietnam War, and we had families living with us off and on for 15 years of my life. And then my dad loved picking up hitchhikers and homeless people, and so our dining room table was kind of a revolving door of characters that they would bring in and they would, you know, love on and try to help get on their feet. And so as a kid, I didn't have a difficult time understanding that the love of Jesus translates to every culture and every context. And as I got older, I just honestly was looking to go somewhere where a lot of other people wouldn't go, and Haiti was that place. And I wasn't a school teacher by trade or by education, but ended up there through a lot of, you know, neat circumstances, and was teaching the fourth grade, working with at-risk kids whose parents, a lot of them, had died from AIDS or other poverty-related issues. And my now wife was teaching the second grade, and after a year of friendship development, it was like, wow, she loves living here. This is crazy. And I need to, you know, pursue this friendship a little bit further. And so God just had our paths cross in a really unique way there, and then led us back to the States 4 years later.
Okay. So another kind of nutty thing about your story is that you were only 29 when Southland kind of came knocking at your door and basically saying, hey, do you want to be the pastor of this church?
Sure.
What is that about? How were you even received? And how did you go from, yeah, I was a teacher in Haiti, so now let me just take on this church?
Yeah, well, Haiti and white suburban America are two very different cultures.
I would imagine, yeah.
Yeah, so at 26, I moved back up here, and, you know, I honestly, it was a very loving church family that had incredible DNA spiritually and just had a heart for their community and needed some direction, and I didn't think I was the guy they were going to look at. I was actually playing pickup basketball in the driveway when they called me, and I didn't know I was going to an interview. I was in gym shorts and a sweaty T-shirt, and I walk in this house, and all these church leaders are there, and they had me sit down, and the conversation just took a really neat turn as we talked about simple ways to love our neighborhoods, and mm-hmm. we found common ground in that. And I said, you know, I have no desire to be a pastor. That's not a title I'm really looking for. But, you know, as I follow Jesus, I'd love to encourage other people to do the same. So we had this simple kind of mindset, and I really felt like the Spirit was leading us together. And 16 years later, haven't regretted any of it. It's been challenging at times, but seen a lot of growth, and we're doing a lot of, you know, unique things here in our context.
Yeah. And you were saying about how many people were part of the church body at that time when you kind of joined the staff?
Yeah, when I joined the staff, the church was running around 6,000 people. So it was a good sized church.
Okay.
And had good momentum and, you know, decent critical mass.
Yeah.
If you will.
Okay, so clearly you probably had some assumptions going in, and that was, I would imagine it was like, here's this great body of believers, and they're just ready to serve and ready to just be unified and all this kind of stuff. Did you have some disappointments in that?
Sure. You know, stepping into, you know, multi-generational church, their preferences, people have a specific way they want to see church done, and a lot of those are framed up by traditions instead of scripture. And so for several years I thought, I'm going to be here a long time. The goal is not to make everybody mad and upset the apple cart. It's to grow together. And so I focused on Jesus and the Gospels and said he's the center of the Bible. He needs to be the center of our lives and our theology. And we moved from just orthodoxy to orthopraxy, the idea of, you know, it's one thing to believe the right things. It's another thing to live the right way. Mm-hmm. And we just simplified our vision around loving God and loving people. And as people started to see how simple Jesus kept it, we were able to translate that into, you know, what's that look like in Central Kentucky? You know, community gardens and Jesus Prom and all the things that we do now, free medical clinics. You know, we provide free health care to 3,500 people in our city every week. And all these ministries that are outside of our four walls, the only thing we do is gather on Sunday. The rest of the week, we're serving our neighbors.
Wow. What I think there's a lot of assumption, especially among young adults, that if you pastor a mega church, either one, you're this super confident extrovert, or two, you're, you know, super spiritual, or you've got all these giftings that just plopped you there or something. What would you say are some of your personal challenges that you have had to work through that probably informed the book, Me Too? And how, you know, how have you seen those played out, you know, both publicly and privately in the ministry you do?
Yeah, my whole life I've wrestled with fear. I had extroverted brothers and a sister and a dad, and I always took the back seat, and I was comfortable back there. I didn't like the attention. I didn't want to talk. So God has a funny sense of humor now. You know, I stand up in front of a lot of people, and I have to fight every week fear and just, you know, some people-pleasing tendencies that I've had. I've gone through some counseling for that. And at the same time, my own bag of pain and restlessness that I've just had my whole life. And that's what the book is about. It's, you know, that suffering is the common language of humanity. It's, we're all fluent in it, and it's a common denominator that should draw us together, but instead it tends to drive people apart. And I think at our church, that's what we've tried to do, is just build a community centered around honesty and humility, that, you know what, it life's hard, and we don't need to hide that or act like as Christians we're exempt from it. So we've built our whole culture around it, and a lot of that was rooted in my own dealings with God and wrestling with him as a father and being his son, and trying to come to grips with all the bad stuff I saw in Haiti with people suffering and dying. So, you know, it's been productive. I'm not out of the woods. I don't think I will be until Jesus comes back or I die. So it's a lifelong battle.
Little rabbit trail I thought of in what you said there. You talked about, you know, just doing life and inviting people in. You're a big proponent of really inviting people into your space, especially in shared meals. Tell us a little bit about your dining room table.
Yeah, my wife grew up in a very abusive home, and she had some friends that set a place for her at their table growing up, and that's where she found comfort and saw a healthy family. And so as she's gotten older and we've established our own home, hospitality is a big value for us, and we want to express it. And so we invite people into our house a lot to eat, and we've just found when people put their feet under a table, they drop their guard. So we eat, and then at the end of the night, she gives everybody a Sharpie, and they lay on their back under our table and sign their name. And it sounds kind of goofy and silly, but it allows people to take ownership of our house. We really want them to feel like there's this safe territory in our city where at any time, no matter what they're going through, they can come and be a part of our family because God's adopted us into his. And that's totally birthed out of, again, my wife's healing through some childhood woundedness.
How have you, John, in light of this, I mean, you talked about the community ministry that goes on, the lives, you know, people being in one another's lives, ministering to others who aren't necessarily part of the church. How do you cast a vision for the members of your church who are probably, you know, struggling with, you know, that temptation to wallow in their own misery, you know, focus on their own problems, be all about themselves, to really see that healing can come through community and through being in one another's lives and actually impacting others? How did you cast that vision, and how was it received?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the main thing I've done is just talked about my own struggles from stage and let people know that, yes, I'm saved and my sins are forgiven and my eternal destination is secure, but I still have the same issues that everybody else has. My marriage isn't perfect. I'm confused as a parent oftentimes. I wrestle with greed and pride and lust like everybody else does. And so it started with me kind of dropping the guard and losing all the big church lingo and, you know, pastor credentials and all that kind of stuff and just being honest. And people found that refreshing, I think, and at the same time realized that in our own struggle, we do have hope, and that's what the world doesn't have. And so we need to not be stingy with that or keep it to ourselves. We need to share that every chance we get. So instead of coming to church for 1,000 Bible studies, just be Jesus where you're at. Be Jesus in your home. Be Jesus in with the people you work with. I coach Little League baseball, so it gives me a chance on the ball field just to be around families and rub shoulders with people. And I tell our church all the time, just don't be weird. Like, there's enough like weird, goofy Christians out there. Mm-hmm. Be true to your personality and who God made you to be. And, you know, be honest about what you're really dealing with. And that's magnetic, because the hope part is what most people don't have. They're suffering alone. Mm-hmm. They're suffering without answers. And we have direction with that, and we need to share that direction.
Yeah. Now I know if I ever try to join your church and someone's like, we have a behind-the-scenes role for you, I'll know what that's about. So
yeah, you definitely
thanks
know.
For,
right.
Thanks for cluing me in on that.
That's exactly right.
I could see where, John, the 20-somethings in your church would be like all over this vision, and they would probably have all these ideas that they want to bring to the table. How do you get them to value the wisdom of the older generations in your church and get them to work together rather than being, super smug about, you know, let's put everything on social media and like make this about a big, you know, media relations profile, let's get on MTV and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, that can be challenging at times. We have multi-generational challenges like a lot of churches do, but we've really encouraged the people, the older people that have stayed with us, they're sold out to this vision. They love seeing younger people come. And, you know, I say the older people bring wisdom, the younger people bring passion, and the two are a lethal combination when they're partnered up. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we've tried to do, is partner people together. And they've enjoyed that. It's been fun to watch people serve together. We have a ministry to exotic dancers, and you know, a lot of older women and a lot of younger women are involved in that, and they're rescuing women together. And I love seeing them link arms, but it's around a common call to love our neighbors ourselves. And that's been the key thing, is the death to self. Like, it doesn't matter how old you are, how young you are. It matters if you're willing to lay down your life for the good of someone else. And that's what Jesus did, and that's why we love him, and that's what's compelling about our love in our city is, you know, we're just showing people it doesn't matter what generation you're from, we're all willing to sacrifice for your good, no matter what that is and what that entails. And I've seen old and young come around that, and they're willing to lay down, again, their preferences or their preconceived ideas about ministry to accomplish things together, and there's power in that.
Do you have any Christian ministry, like leaders who are heroes to you, who really have inspired your vision for ministry and service in the context that you're doing it?
Yeah, over the years, probably my parents played the biggest role in that because they kept it so simple. Mm-hmm. I can remember my parents just, again, if they had extra money, that was supposed to be used for the good of someone else. And we would actually pray for and then go looking for people in need instead of, you know, waiting for the opportunity to come to us or just cutting a check and sitting in a church building. It was this very active, you know, God pursued us, so we're going to go pursue people. And I think over the years, I've tried to do my best to build on the foundation that they laid, and I'm very grateful. My dad, you know, would just, again, listen to anybody, and that was the key. He was an incredible listener, and I've oftentimes said, you know, love doesn't assume. Love asks, hey, what can I do for you? And then whatever the person says is their need, we're on the hook to meet that need. And oftentimes people just need us to listen to them. Mm-hmm. We're so busy and people aren't paying attention to people today. And my dad just taught me, man, if you stop and really look them in the eyes and pay attention to them, that'll speak value to them. And that'll give you an opportunity at some point to share Jesus.
Yeah. Can you talk with us just briefly, like, what that looks like? Because I can imagine, you know, how you sit down or, look into the eyes of or share a cup of coffee with an exotic dancer or an addict or, you know, quite frankly, let's be honest, even a lifelong Christian, because we believe all our own lies too. you know, and sure. Then how do you move from that to the I'm meeting you where you are, I'm validating who you are, I'm sharing this space with you to, and by the way, there's this guy named Jesus. Like what, what, you know, I mean, because I think people could be like, oh, here's the bait and switch. It's a pastor guy coming after me.
Yeah. I think the key in all of it is prayer. Mm. You know, you're asking God for the right timing. If your heart's in the right place, he's going to give you the opportunity at some point, and he's going to open the door. So it's trusting in that unseen power to do things that we can't do or that we don't want to manipulate or coerce or force on our own. So using an example, a friend of mine had a coworker who was wrestling with depression, and it manifested itself in a lot of different ways. And so he was trying to just, you know, pray into the situation and stay close to this guy. And finally he said over lunch, hey, I'm really worried about you, and I just want to know how I can help. Like, there's no judgment on my end. And he shared his own story and battle through some pornography addiction to let the guy know that he was human. And so finally this guy opened up and shared his struggle with, you know, just daily sadness, like the clouds were never going to go away. And so my buddy said, hey, can I invite you into my house, or can I come live with you just so you have someone? You need a friend. And the guy actually took him up on it and said, yeah, you can come live with me. I need that. I'm just lonely at night. Mm-hmm. And come to find out his wife had left him and taken their kids. And you know, he's just deeply saddened by it and grieving. So my buddy moved in with him and literally a few weeks later was sleeping on the floor in this guy's bedroom as just a presence in his life. Like, I'm not going anywhere. And just demonstrate, I'll cook, I'll do whatever I've got to do to help you get out of this funk or help you navigate it with medicine and God's help, like how you can deal with this. And he would write scripture on little note cards and, you know, tape it on this guy's bathroom mirror and just help him understand that he was God's son and he mattered to God. And it was really natural and organic. It's weird, but it's also just in the everyday flow of life. And eventually this guy got to a place where, you know, he was in counseling, and then through the counseling, you know, my buddy was able to say, hey, I go to this church and you ought to come with me sometime. And, you know, immediately this guy was kind of like, oh, you know, it's like you're talking about, I knew this was going to be at the end of all this, you know, this weird ask. And he said, no, it's not what you think. And so his first introduction to church wasn't a weekend service. It was his life group. Hmm. He said, why don't you come to our weekly meal? And so he brought the guy to that for several months before the guy ever stepped foot in our church. And that community of people and their love for one another was so compelling that then it kind of catapulted him into church and into a relationship with Christ. But, you know, it started with a conversation. It started with a, hey, I'm concerned about you. Then, you know, moved in with the guy, cooked for him, did all the errand running that he needed for several months. And, I mean, that's not easy, and that's really disruptive to your routine. But it means that someone's going to be in heaven. And at the end of the day, that's what matters to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What, John, would you say, like, to a Christian millennial in your church who's maybe tempted to hang at the edges of the congregation and what you guys have going on, or else seek out maybe some of the more glamorous opportunities or ministries? What does that look like for a 20-something who needs to understand the value of community and of dying to self and sacrifice for the sake of, you know, the body of Christ?
Yeah, anyone that's in a selfish kind of state, I would say you need to go on a mission trip. You need to come serve. You know, that's our first step out of the weekend service. We want you to serve. You need to roll up your sleeves and get your hands dirty. You know, Jesus was a foot washer, and he told us to wash dirty feet. There's nothing glamorous about our role as his disciples. It is all about crucifixion, and it's all about other-centric kind of living. And we don't like that. We are a consumer culture, and we want to get something from this. But what I would tell those folks is you're going to get what your heart desires when you start serving other people. And you can't buy that with money, and you can't find that in a church program. I'm talking about the fruit of the Spirit. You're going to get love and joy and increased, you know, levels of gentleness, and all the things that your heart really craves will come when you lay your life down. So get off your hands, get off your butt, and get in the game. There's too much at stake, and there's too much good that you'll receive when you start to give.
Hmm. And then the converse of that, how do you ensure, I mean, with a multi-thousand member church, how do you ensure that that hurting person, the person in pain, it could be a, you know, a person on the fringe, or it could be one of your core members, how do you ensure that they are seen in the midst of the multitude?
Yeah, it's invitation. You know, Jesus offered invitation all the time and people took him up on it. And I think that's what churches have to do. You have to be very invitational in your language and you have to be committed to follow up. You cannot let people slip through the cracks. And as the church gets bigger, we have to work really hard at intimacy. And we believe that comes through vulnerability. So we try to connect people as quickly as we can to groups and to individuals so that they don't get lost in the masses. And it's not always easy, and we don't always do a perfect job of it, but we're honest about that. And if we need to apologize to people, we apologize, but it's definitely not our heart, and we try to work really hard at over-communicating that and making that a lifestyle for us. So everybody's a pastor in our church. It's not just the people that get paid, and that language change has to happen to you. Like, I'm the lead follower. I'm not a senior minister or lead pastor. I'm just out there following Jesus and inviting other people to do the same. So our terminology is a little bit different as well.
Yeah.
We've tried to root that in as much of what we see in the New Testament as possible.
Yeah. Well, as we wrap up here, something that I think is going to rock people's socks off, tell us just quickly about the Jesus Prom.
Yeah, we realized that there was a demographic, about 2,500 adults in our city who have a physical or mental challenge. And so Jesus said in Luke 14, when you throw parties, don't invite your friends and family. Instead, invite the lame, crippled, blind, and poor. And we realized this is a group of people that Jesus has a heart for, and the church is just not paying attention to them or their caregivers. So 15 years ago, we started a party called Jesus Party, and then it turned into a prom because most of them had never been invited to their high school prom. So we roll out a red carpet, put disco balls throughout our church, and put out the best banquet and send out tuxedos and limousines and prom dresses, and we pick them up. And our goal is to help them understand that they are the prized citizens of heaven. And our middle school and high school and college students serve as dance partners, and we put the best band on stage. And I'm convinced if Jesus were alive the night of our party, he'd be in our church cutting a rug with some of these folks. And it's just electric, and it's changed our church. And these folks and their families are now, you know, a part of our church family, and we wouldn't change that. And the cool thing is God's taken Jesus Prom and, you know, multiplied it in other churches around the United States. And it's been cool to see, because Jesus knew if you love the least of these, it'll do something for your heart. And that's, you know, heaven on earth, everything that he wanted come to life, and we're excited about it.
Yeah. That is just like a tear fest waiting to happen.
I'm currently
caregiving for my mom, who has dementia. So I just think of, you know, her as a younger generation person and the impact that has on them. That's just amazing. So
yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Okay. Well, folks, this has been John Weiss. We've been talking to him, the great ministry that he is doing out there in Lexington and beyond, really being an example of how ministry can be done when it is literally taking it to the streets, ministering to people's hearts, inviting people into your home. His book, Me Too, that we've been talking about, is yours for a gift of any amount. Hop over to boundless.org and you can click on the image of the resource there. We would love this to be our gift to you. So we're going to make this book available. So check it out and get a copy for a friend as well. So, John, thank you so much for being part of this conversation.
Lisa, thanks for having me. If I can ever do anything for you or anyone else, let me know.
You can't. I might want to be invited to the prom, so I'm going to let you know.
Come on. We'd love to have you.
Okay.
We'd love to have you.
You just wait for my call.
Okay. All right. I'm all over it.
Thank you so much.